Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Well, good morning and welcome to this week's edition of Driven to Business. I am your host, as always, Eddie Mayfield. And as always, we're glad you're here. We appreciate you listening. We always try to have programs that are of interest to a wide range of listeners, dealing with business, business issues, business theories, business startups, business failures, you name it. Our guest today is Kyle Jackson. Kyle is the Georgia State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business, or NFIB. Kyle, welcome to Driven to Business.
Good morning, Eddie. It's good to be with you.
It's good to have you back on the program. We talked about a year ago, and you were very interesting, and I've been looking forward to having you back, especially being as at the Georgia State Legislature just finished their year, and you played another big role in that, as you always do.
Yeah, you know, it was a fast and furious year with the changes to the election calendar. A little bit more of a compressed session this year. I think there was some concern going in. There wasn't going to be much appetite to get much accomplished. And I know a lot of the characterization by the media looking at the session has been about guns and abortion and things of that nature. But, you know, it actually was all in all a pretty good session for small business, too.
Kyle, just for folks that I think that is probably not many people listening that don't know what the NFIB is, but just in a nutshell, tell us what the National Federation of Independent is all about.
Yeah, we are the state and the country's largest trade association dedicated to representing the interests of small business owners. All we represent, all we are small employers. Our average member has less than 20 employees, does less than $1 million a year in gross sales. So they're really kind of what you think of as your traditional Main Street USA type of small employers. We've got folks in Washington who work on federal public policy with Congress and the president. And then what I do here in Georgia is I represent our members at the Gold Dome and on state issues and work with the governor and his administration and legislature to try to do good things on behalf of small employers.
You know, the NFIB is a very effective lobbying organization, or trade association, as you organization of small businesses, as you say, both on the national and the state level. I think to a lot of us here in Georgia, it's a lot more visible here on the state level because we see you and what you're doing, and we hear our state representatives talk about the bills that they're sponsoring that are business friendly. And Georgia is, I think you and I talked before, Georgia is overall a generally business friendly state, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say so. Like with anything in life, there are certainly things we could always do better. But I think when you take a holistic view of the state, I think we're a pretty good place to own and operate a small business. I know Governor Deal has made frequent reference to Site Selection Magazine's naming of Georgia as the number one place to operate a business.
And right.
We typically fare pretty well in other publications as well.
Now, Cal, let's talk a minute about some national issues that are of interest, I think, to all of us because they do affect us. And I know your primary role is that of the state director of the National Federation of Independent Business, but you are involved as part of that national effort. And as you said, you guys do have lobbyists in D.C. and so forth. A couple of things that I know the NFIB is working for recently, you know, there's been a change that could affect a lot of small businesses in how the administration has asked the Labor Department to redefine who is eligible for overtime. Are you up on that at all?
Yeah, we are. And it's certainly of concern and concerning to many small employers. It's kind of par for the course for this administration and just another opportunity, I think, to kind of kick small business owners in the teeth at a time, frankly, where we should be doing everything we can to prop up small business and to let them and help them be successful. But the overtime proposal, much like the minimum wage proposal, is geared very much at small business. I think it disproportionately impacts in a negative way small business, and it really changes the entire dynamic of the way we think about compensation.
Well, you know, just for those that may not know, and you correct me, you're a lot more familiar with these things than I am, but if the regulations as proposed, if I understand them, basically if you have a salaried employee who in the past has not been eligible for overtime, now if they make up to, I think if they make something like $970 a week or less, which is about $50,000 a year, give or take, then they become eligible for overtime if they work more than 40 hours per week. And the danger for that, for a lot of us in small businesses, is we have a lot of salaried employees that are helping us get the business going, and they're kind of with a lot of us on the idea that they will share in the benefits of the business as the business grows. It's just sort of an understood thing between us. We're going to reward them as the business grows, and in a lot of small businesses, in that growth, both the owner and key employees that are probably in that salary range are working very long and hard hours to get the business up so they can all be rewarded. Well, this is going to stop that. And right. Basically, a lot of businesses could not afford to pay the overtime. So what they're going to say is, you can't work more than 40 hours a week. Sorry, you got to go home.
Or they'll be forced to cut positions, and the person who's working overtime is going to be working a lot of overtime. And as you alluded to, I found that most small employers, they treat their employees like extended family. And when the business experiences success, it's kind of the notion that, it's good when all boats rise.
Right.
And that's true in small business. And, I find that most employers will go out of their way to try to offer a competitive benefits and compensation package, because you want to be able to find and keep good people. Otherwise, you're not going to have a very successful business. So here again, I just think it's another example of the president in Washington being completely out of touch with the way things work in the real world. And unfortunately, it's just another assault on small business.
I had read an article on the NFIB website some time back that your chief economist, or at least at that time, a guy named Bill Dunkelberger, he was basically talking about that the existing companies, existing small businesses, are the key to job growth in this country. And when you start messing around with that, it's self-defeating. As you said a while ago, a business owner that can't pay that additional money, then he has to get rid of that person, and because there's just not enough money to go around. And so that's just the hard, cold facts of it.
And I think that's being manifested in, most people consider us not to be in a recession anymore, but I would say at best, it's been a pretty tepid and slow recovery. And I think part of the reason for that has been these policies and these executive orders and these proposals, whether it's the minimum wage or overtime or the Affordable Care Act and all its mandates and regulations, the tidal wave of regulations proposed by the administration, that all has a dampening effect on small businesses' ability to create jobs. And what we know from past recessions is that it's the small employers that carry us out of recessions. And I think the reason that we've been so slow in coming out of this recession is because small employers are just, they're struggling, one, and two, they're fearful and reluctant to hire because they don't know what's coming down the pipeline next from Washington.
The biggest problems, again, you guys survey your members, of which I'm one, I should say that.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, I've been an NFIB member for a long time, actually. The company I worked for before I started my own business was an NFIB member. I think any small business should be part of that. But when you survey the problems that small businessmen and women across the country say their biggest concerns are taxes, and taxes is not just federal taxes. There are all sorts of taxes you have to deal with, and it's scary, and they all worry you because you never know what they're going to do. And the second thing they're concerned about is regulation, both local, state, and federal regulation of all kinds of things. And the other thing that I think a lot of people in government don't understand, but absolutely fits in with everybody I know, they're concerned about poor sales. And those other two things, if you're taking up time messing around with those other things, well, then you don't get to deal with the poor sales side of it, which is really the way you grow business and the way you hire people. You've got to get that up. And I think part of the problem with an overzealous federal, state, or local government is that if you pull a guy's time out of that and resources to growing his business, to either meeting some regulation he doesn't understand or studying or paying some lawyer or something to help him understand it, stay out of trouble, well, then he's not improving his business. And while he's not doing that, he's not growing, he's not hiring people, he's not contributing to the economy. And I just think, Kyle, that a lot of people at government just don't have that perception of business people.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, you're reading from the gospel there, a small business owner, because I think that's pretty consistently what we hear, and it's one of the frustrations. You know, my experience, whether it's with elected officials or government bureaucrats, is that most people tend to want to try to do the right thing. The problem I think we have, and it's really acute, I think, in Washington, to a much lesser extent here in Georgia, is that there are too few people who have worked in or operated or owned a business of their own. And so they don't understand when you propose a regulation and a small business owner says, well, geez, that's awfully burdensome for me. They don't have the ability to empathize and understand why that's problematic for small employers. And there's a real, I think there's a real disconnect, and that's hurting our economy, and I think it's hurting job creation in this country.
I think when a lot of people talk about business, they have the idea of these large multinational firms and all that's going on, when in reality, a very large percent of small businesses have 10 or fewer employees. I mean, that's the mom and pop people that you're dealing with, and those people just don't have, you know, people like me, we don't have lawyers on staff,
right,
to send out and deal with things like this. You know, we don't have an accountant on staff. That's something we outsource. And so when you make a change, it requires a lot more accounting rules. It just means we have to buy more accounting time from somebody.
It's less time and less money you have to put in to why you got into business in the first place, and that's, you know, creating your widget or selling your widget or whatever it is that you do. And that's, you know, it's one of the biggest things that we always try to stress to lawmakers of any level, is that whenever you're asking the private sector to do something, one, it's important to keep in mind that the way Delta does business is a lot different than the way, you know, your local hardware store does business, or I guess a better example would be Home Depot versus your local hardware store.
Right.
You know, the ability for Home Depot to, you know, have an on-site legal department and human resources and accounting and IT, and you know, you just don't have that in small businesses. They're incapable and they're unequipped of dealing with things as quickly or as cheaply as their big business competitors. And when you create the regulatory burden and you make it more difficult for small employers, not only is it more difficult for small employers, but it's also more difficult for those small employers to compete in the marketplace with large employers.
Which is why we have people like you. And we'll be back after the break in just a moment. You're with Driven to Business. Be right back. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Hey, keep in mind, we are streaming live, even as we speak right now, on biz1190.com. And today's program will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com. And in that podcast, in the written part of it, you will find links to Kyle and his organization. And if you're not a member of NFIB and you're a small business owner, well, you ought to be. Kyle, let's talk about the legislative session this time. That takes up a lot of your time here in Georgia, is dealing with these the issues that the legislature handles, and you basically are a lobbyist for small business in that area.
Yep, that's very much true. We in Georgia, we meet for 40 days a year, 40 days that the House and Senate are in session. Sometimes that's stretched out over 4 or 5 months. Sometimes that's a little more compressed, as we saw this year, many more 5-day work weeks. It's interesting, people talk about the legislature, and what they don't realize is that the only constitutionally bound responsibility they have every year is to pass a budget. So they did that this year, but they also did some other things, some things that we like and some things that we'd like to see them improve upon.
I was telling you during the break that one of the things I was glad to see this time was the elimination of the what's been referred to as the death tax, I like that name for it, or the inheritance tax here in Georgia. Now there's still a federal tax. We can talk about that. But I in particular was interested in that because my representative, B.J. Pack, from the Lilburn area up there, was a sponsor of that in the House. I know you were very involved in that. Tell us about that, how that happened.
Yeah, you know, the estate tax, or as we refer to it, the death tax, or the inheritance tax, as some people refer to it, it's a real problem for multi-generational family businesses, because you know, you pay taxes on all your income, all the equipment and machinery you buy over the years you operate a business, and then when you die and you want to pass your business on to your son or your daughter or your family, then you have to pay a tax on that stuff all over again. And it's a real burden. It's a real burden for small family farms. It's a real burden for small employers, and it's a burden for mid-sized employers too. And we've seen families decide to liquidate assets and sell their business instead of having to deal with trying to carry on with the estate tax. And so, yeah, the legislature passed a bill this year to eliminate that entirely from code. Georgia had had some set-offs for a number of years that minimized the impact of the estate or the death tax, but we were very much happy and excited to see that eliminated altogether. And Representative Pack did a tremendous job in carrying that legislation.
You know, I think of all the taxes that I think are most unfair, and I would even go as far as to say immoral, I think that the inheritance tax or estate tax is an immoral tax. It is something that, you know, you work all your life to do something. You do pay taxes on the money you've made. It's not that you got it tax-free.
And yeah, absolutely. There's a big misnomer about the estate tax. There's a real lack of understanding. Again, as you alluded to, you know, this is money and assets that have already been taxed. You've already paid tax on. Then you go to turn them over to your heirs. And in our focus, it's particularly on, again, these family businesses that, you know, I'm always excited and you always want to hear about these third, fourth, fifth generation family businesses. And frankly, the estate tax makes it very difficult for those families to pass that business on to the next generation.
You know, you hear stories. I've heard stories of farmers in particular who had large farms, and, you know, they were kind of land rich and cash poor. Mm-hmm. But they turn those family farms, family-run farms, over to their heirs, and their heirs have to end up selling off part of the farm just to pay the estate taxes. Well, that's absurd.
You know, farming is a good example too, Eddie, because you look at, you may own a lot of land, and you also may own a couple combines or a couple heavy-duty agricultural tractors, and
right.
You know, those aren't cheap. And somebody may look at the value of your assets as saying, well, you've got, you know, a few million dollars worth of assets, but those are assets that are being used on a daily basis to produce whatever crops, you know, whatever livestock you're raising. And when you have to sell off part of that, it really cripples the ability for somebody to operate an agribusiness anymore.
What do you think is a chance? You know, it's the federal estate tax got lowered, you know, effectively for a while, but now, if I understand correctly, it's back up. What do you think is the chances of that eventually being done away with?
You know, eventually, I think what you're more likely to see is some kind of long-term exemption. I know we've been pushing, I think, for at the national level, like a $5 million exemption, so the
right.
First $5 million of assets. Because, you know, the other side likes to talk about, well, you know, Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, when they die, they're going to have these billions in assets. And for the reality is that for most people that get hit with the estate tax, they're not Bill Gates and they're not Warren Buffett.
Exactly.
And we're very much worried about making sure that we can protect those multi-generational family businesses and protect the assets that people have built up over their lives and pay taxes on year after year. And when it's time to turn those businesses and those assets over to their kids, we just don't think they should be hit with such a massive penalty. At the federal level, you know, I think short-term prospects probably aren't very good on anything tax-related. Again, we've been pushing for at least a $5 million exemption long-term. I think it would be very difficult to eliminate the estate tax altogether, again, because the other side is going to throw up these examples of people who are billionaires, and it just, when you talk to the general public, that's who they're going to think of. They're not going to think of their neighborhood restaurateur who maybe owns two or three restaurants and is just as much going to get hit with that death tax as you know, the billionaire out in California.
I think it's our job, and you do a good job with this, of explaining that perhaps to people so they do understand that these are real people. These are your neighbors you're affecting. These are not there are multi-billionaires in the country. There's very few of them. That's a small group of people. And honestly, even from a moral standpoint, for me, if they worked, you know, no one gave either Bill Gates or Warren Buffett their money. They earned it. Those guys didn't inherit their money. And so whose right is it to come in there and say, oh, you've got enough and we need to take it from you? I don't buy any of that, actually. I don't even buy the premise of that at all. Even at that level. But I think you're all right. The public's view of that is that these guys are so rich it doesn't hurt them anyway. They don't think about the guy that owns the auto repair shop down the street trying to leave it to his family, and it's him getting hit with this thing too.
And those are the folks that we're trying to protect by this, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, talk to us about e-discovery, what that was.
Yeah,
about.
E-discovery. Here's another one where some of your listeners' eyes may glaze over, but it's a very important issue.
It's very important.
I would put it under the umbrella of what we call tort or civil justice reform. A lot of people don't know that Georgia is only one of 10 states that doesn't have anything in state law governing what we call e-discovery or electronic discovery. So these days in the process of a civil lawsuit, whereas in days gone by, you probably would have been asked to produce copies of hard copies of documents that you had in your file cabinet. Nowadays, most of your files, if not all your files, are saved somewhere on a hard drive or they're in emails or off-site storage somewhere. And that's what e-discovery is all about. The problem that we have in Georgia right now is since we don't have any parameters on e-discovery, we've had some small employers involved in civil suits, and the trial lawyers will ask for enormous amounts of data and information, and it's very expensive, it's very time-consuming for people to produce that data, and particularly for small employers. And so what trial lawyers have figured out is if you can ask for an overbroad and expensive discovery process, you can intimidate some of these small employers into just settling instead of going through the process and paying all this money to find the documents and run the risk that something has been accidentally destroyed or deleted, and then you're looking at potential court sanctions. So that's what e-discovery is all about. We had a piece of legislation this year that was modeled after what some other states had done, including some things that were in federal rules and federal statute. It's a pretty fair and balanced. I think it protected the right of somebody to sue and tried to make the process, I think, more clear and predictable for the defendants to understand what kind of documents they needed to keep and for how long. Got introduced in the House, unfortunately got a little watered down, passed the House, went back to the Senate, and it got strengthened in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And then when it got to the floor of the Senate, we got a majority of votes, but not enough votes for it to actually pass the Senate. And we had some senators who got up and what we call walked, had other things going on, or just chose not to vote. And ultimately, it doomed our efforts to pass e-discovery reform this year.
Do you think you don't have to name any names, but do you think the choosing not to vote was a result of lobbying by the trial lawyers and so forth?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the trial bar was very much opposed to seeing this pass this year.
Hey, BJ, we got to take another break here. If you got folks can hang around, more Driven to Business on the way. Stick around. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I am your host every week here on WAFS Biz 1190, Eddie Mayfield, and we're glad you're here. We're here every Saturday morning, by the way, at 11 o'clock, so tell your friends and tune in. We are streaming live on biz1190.com, and today's program will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com, so you've got a lot of ways to check us out. We are talking with Kyle Jackson, the state director, the Georgia State Director, I should say, of the National Federation of Independent Business. Cal, before the break, which I sort of ran you into, I'm sorry for missing the time cues, we were talking about this e-discovery which got defeated this time in the Senate, but it's part of a tort reform situation. Kind of pick up what you're talking about, is the burden this can place on a small business or an individual.
Yeah, so the fact that, as I said earlier, Georgia is one of 10 states that doesn't really have a statute to provide guidelines to judges. It exposes not just small businesses, but medium-sized businesses and large corporations and you and I as individuals to potentially a tremendous amount of liability in the area of electronic discovery. And that, just think about the number of emails and text messages and the things of that nature that you send on a daily basis. Now, imagine you're involved in a lawsuit that is at the heart of the matter, maybe something that took place over 6 months, and the opposing lawyer says, hey, we want all your text messages and emails from the last 3 years.
Yeah.
Now, you'd be pretty hard-pressed to come up with all those, because in the course of your daily life, we delete emails, we delete text messages. It's not an attempt to hide something. It's just, my phone can only hold so much,
exactly.
And we try to keep our inboxes clean. So that's really the problem, I think, without some guidelines and predictability for this discovery process for electronic documents, I think that we have done our employers a tremendous disservice by not passing legislation this year.
Tort reform is a bit of a hot issue for me. I've been sued twice, and neither time did I go to court, but in both times it cost a wad of money. And part of the way it costs money is they basically, the opposing attorneys can flood you with discovery.
Right.
And you know, if you're a business like me, when you're getting asked for business records, well, I have to pull my CPA in to deal with that. And so I'm paying, you know, money, a lot of dollars per hour, for a CPA to stand there and go through these figures to find out what it is exactly we're supposed to be providing and all that. Even when the you may feel that the basis of the lawsuit was frivolous, I felt that way in both of the ones that I was sued by. And nothing ever happened from them, but it ended up costing a fortune. And it does kind of drive you just to settle. It's very intimidating. And I think someone that's not been sued doesn't understand how you can just suddenly get flooded with documents and requests for documents. And I wasn't even being asked to provide. This was a long time ago. I wasn't even being asked to provide electronic data. I can't imagine now what a nightmare that would be to be told I had to produce every email for the last 3 years.
It's very confusing. It's very intimidating, as you alluded to. I mean, I think that's why you see very few civil lawsuits actually go to trial. It's because most people will make the business decision that, you know what, it's cheaper for me to write this $10,000, $15,000, whatever it is, settlement, right, instead of having to go through, you know, I'm paying my attorney a few hundred bucks an hour, and every time we get on a call or produce documents, I'm paying him. I got to bring my accountant or my CPA into it. It's very expensive. It's very time consuming. And whether it's a lawsuit that has a good basis or not, it's still very expensive. And
right,
one of the concerns we have is that the cost of litigation is going up. And that's why we're very much committed to passing and supporting these type of civil justice reforms. It's not to try to keep people who are injured or harmed in some way from
right,
getting their owed. It's to try to weed out some of the frivolous things. It's to try to make the process a little easier and more navigable for small employers.
You know, it's maybe an unfair question to ask you off the top of your head without you having your notes here, but can you give us a few things other besides e-discovery here that the NFIB has been pushing perhaps for some time in terms of tort reform, just a few points of that?
Sure. Yeah. Well, we had one victory this year on a civil justice issue, and it's an important issue for anybody who owns property or land. It's trespasser liability.
I saw that.
There's been an effort by the trial bar to basically expose landowners to more burden and to more liability. And it's kind of a complicated way of getting at saying basically what this bill does is it codifies the duties and responsibilities that you as a landowner have to a trespasser. And it's a way to prevent landowners from being exposed to unnecessary and undue liability.
It seems common sense, because I'm not a lawyer, but it seems common sense that if someone is trespassing on your property and they fall in a hole, that's their problem.
I didn't ask them to come here.
I
have found that sometimes common sense is lacking when it comes to dealing with matters of civil justice.
Exactly.
Another one, for example, is, you know, in the state of Georgia, you're required, I'm required, everybody's required to wear a seatbelt when they're riding around in their car or truck. If not, you could get a ticket for it.
Right.
But when it comes to incidences where there's an auto accident and there's a lawsuit, whether or not I or you wore a seatbelt, in terms of figuring damages, is inadmissible in court, and the juries can't actually consider that when they're trying to figure out, okay, well, how much responsibility was the auto manufacturer, how much responsibility was you as the driver, how much responsibility was as me as maybe the driver who caused the accident. They cannot consider in Georgia whether or not you were wearing a seatbelt. Now, it's the state law you have to wear a seatbelt, but because we don't have a statute dealing with that, juries can't consider whether or not I was wearing a seatbelt. And we also know that if you don't wear a seatbelt, you're exposing yourself potentially to a lot more bodily harm and injury.
A company I worked for in Texas many years ago, there was a person injured on an industrial machine. And we had had a service guy out there, and they had asked him to jump out all of the emergency stops on the machine, and he refused to do it. He said, that's not safe operation. He said, you know, you can do that, but I'm not going to do it. And he left, and they undid all the safeties because it was an intermittent problem with stopping the machine, so they just undid the safeties. Well, then some guy gets in there, and I don't remember what happened. I think he got his arm torn off, actually. I think it was actually a very serious accident. Well, when they started suing people, the company that I worked for then, they sued us as well because they pretty much sued anybody that had ever been near that machine and had worked on it. And then one of the allegations made against the company that I worked for then was, you know, that when your guy told them that was unsafe, he in effect assumed the role of an expert, and he should have guaranteed they did not, even though they owned the machine, not him, and they were paying us to be there.
Yeah, you know, there again, common sense is not so common when it comes to dealing with some of these issues, unfortunately.
No, it's really not. Hey, tell us about unemployment reform here in the state.
Yeah, it's been a pretty important few years ever since the economic downturn. Georgia, like many other states, their trust fund, or the fund that we used to pay out unemployment benefits, went into the negative. We had to borrow several hundred million dollars from the federal government. Of course, anytime you borrow from the federal government, that money has to be repaid, typically with strings attached.
Exactly.
So a couple of years ago, we were able to pass a pretty comprehensive reform package to get our trust fund and our system in a better place. I'm excited and happy to report that I think we're looking at, by the end of this year, we're going to be back in the black on our trust fund, and that money will be repaid to the federal government. But the good thing about people paying more attention to unemployment is that we will also be able to ferret out and discover some loopholes and some abuse of the unemployment system. And we actually passed a bill this year, House Bill 714, that dealt with one of those loopholes or abuse of the systems. And to make it very simple, is try to explain it as best I can, it had to do with seasonal workers working in educational settings. And there are a handful of companies in Georgia who were at the maximum experience rating by the federal government. So they were paying as much as they possibly could in unemployment benefits, but the amount of benefits that their employees were drawing out was in some cases a million or a couple million dollars more than what they were paying into the system. So in effect, what these companies were doing was basically using the unemployment system to subsidize their employees' wages. And the reason that was a problem for us and for others is that our members, in effect, were subsidizing the shortfall.
Exactly. That means my company is paying for those people to do that, too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So we were able to pass legislation to get that corrected, and it's going to save employers in Georgia about $10 million a year. That piece of legislation, all told, represents about $90 million a year to the system and to employers. And so we viewed it very much as a positive development to get that bill passed.
Yeah, my experience with that's one of the things that caught me a little off guard, Kyle, to be honest, when I first got in business, was what we were paying for unemployment. And I was like, wait a minute. And I remember having a discussion one time. We had this very high, I forgot the term, I guess experience level, right? I forget what you call it.
Yeah.
But we had never gotten rid of anyone. And so I said, we've never laid anybody off. Why have I? And they said, well, I was talking about the state, and he said, well, the fact that you haven't laid anybody off means you're a high potential to do so. And I thought, what kind of reasoning is that?
Yeah.
That's crazy. But anyway, and the other thing was, we had, this was many, 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 many years ago, we had fired an employee that just absolutely was not showing up half the time and not doing their job when they showed up. And then they were awarded unemployment compensation. And I got this letter that said they had been, I forgot the term, but unfairly fired is basically what it is, the way I read it, which sort of got my dander up. So I actually got an attorney and went to the appeal process, and I figured out pretty quickly that was a complete waste of money right there.
And that's another area that we are very much interested in working with Commissioner Butler to try to fix. You know, again, I think for a lot of years, employers, unless they were in a business where they had a lot of turnover, just didn't pay much attention to unemployment because it wasn't a big cost as compared to, you know, wages, compensation, and health insurance. But because of the downturn, because of the penalties that some employers were paying, all employers were paying, more people are starting to pay attention to unemployment. And, you know, unemployment is a pretty large system. And with any large system, there's lots of potential for fraud, waste, and abuse. And that's one of our big priorities, both legislatively as well as working with the commissioner, to try to identify and eliminate some of those abuses in the system. Because in the end of the day, it costs everybody money, and it makes it harder for the people who are truly unemployed and in need of that safety net to get those benefits.
Well, Kyle, that's another reason I'm glad we have someone like you sort of with your finger on the button down there and dealing with things like that. And I do appreciate the job that NFIB does. And we've got one more segment to talk to you about if you can stick around. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Keep in mind, we're streaming live on biz1190.com, podcast on eddiemayfield.com. Our guest today is Kyle Jackson with the National Federation of Independent Business. And we will be right back. So stick around. Welcome back to the final segment of today's Driven to Business. We hope you're enjoying it, and we are glad you're here talking with Kyle Jackson, the Georgia State Director of the National Federation of Independent Business. Kyle does a great job here in the state of Georgia in lobbying for those of us in small business, and we appreciate the work that he does. And also, it's nice to have him on the program to catch up sort of on what's going on. Kyle, tell us about it. You're welcome. Your background, you actually have a bit of a small business background. I know the last time I had you on, you told us about it. Can you take just a moment and give us a little bit of that?
Yeah, sure. I grew up in a family of small business owners and entrepreneurs. My mom owned a local hardware store, and my dad owned a John Deere dealership and franchise. And so I spent many years stocking shelves and turning a wrench on a lawnmower, and got come to really appreciate the long hours and the sacrifice and the hard work that goes into building and operating a successful small business. And I think, frankly, it helps me. I like to think it helps me understand and put myself in the shoes of our members and small business owners when I'm down there at the Capitol working on their behalf.
Kyle, tell us, for those of us that probably have no idea how this works exactly, if you've got a legislator that you want to go talk to, he sponsored a bill that perhaps you just feel is not in the interest of small business, or that, how do you approach him? What do you do?
It's a great question, and I would certainly encourage anybody and everybody to get involved. I think there are too few people who take the time to get involved. It's my job. We always try to encourage our members to engage and get involved as well. All the legislators have offices, and they all have administrative staff, and during session, they're typically there 3, 4, 5 days a week. In the off season, some of them keep district offices. You know, I would say that email is a good way to do things. Phone calls are a good way to do things. Emails, I find, tend to be the best, because a lot of times during session, and particularly the latter parts of session, these legislators are not going to be spending a whole lot of time in their office. They're going to be on the floor of the House or the Senate voting on bills, or in committee hearings, hearing bills in committee. So typically the best way to get somebody is not to call their office number, but to, if you've got their personal number, to shoot them a text message, or if you've got their email, to just shoot them an email. They can read something while they're voting on bills. But it's absolutely important that people engage. I can tell you that we try to work very hard and represent a very important segment of Georgia's economy. Oftentimes the people that we're out there working against triple, quadruple me in terms of the number of lobbyists they have. And it's difficult when you're a one-man army to talk to that many legislators. So we really rely and encourage our members to engage as well.
You know, I've certainly do not have anywhere near your experience in lobbying legislators. I have done it a few times. And one of the things I was always a little surprised about, even many years ago, when you would go in to talk to somebody about a bill, perhaps even a bill they were sponsoring, and you would say, well, you know, this bill is going to do this to us. And in many cases, they honestly didn't have any idea the effect that was going to have. And sometimes they would, in fact, change their mind just based on the fact that you pointed out to them what this is going to do to you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and legislators, particularly here in Georgia, where we have a part-time citizen legislature, unlike the folks in Congress who were up there, you know, for all intents and purposes all year, right. You know, our folks are here in Atlanta a few months out of the year. And in that time, they're going to consider, a few thousand bills. Now, not many, that many will actually pass, but, you know, there are lots of bills that get heard in committee, fewer bills that actually pass out of committee, and even fewer that make the floor of the House or the Senate. But it's very difficult. It's very confusing. I found that, frankly, while lobbyists are effective and have their role in the process, some of our best victories and our best efforts have been achieved because small business owners have engaged with their legislators. And I can tell you, it means more to a legislator to hear from a constituent, to hear from a business owner that's in their community creating jobs and employing people, than it does to hear from me, because that's somebody who's a voter, that's somebody who's there in their district, that's somebody who is a shaper of influence and opinions. So, you know, trying to stay on top of things is very difficult. I know we always try to kind of to focus on the top three or four issues and let our people know, hey, here's what's coming up for a vote. Here's why we think it's good or bad. Here's how you can help us either, you know, try to get this piece of legislation passed or get it stopped. And that seemed to work pretty well for us.
You know, I think it was an NFIB meeting gathering some years ago. I'd always sort of taken the approach that I'm not interested in politics, so I don't really want to be involved with that. And some guy there would say, you know, well, you may not want to be involved with politics, but it wants to be involved with you.
So that's very true. Very true. So our old CEO used to say that if you don't get involved in government, government will get involved in your business.
Exactly. They will be involved with you. Hey, and we just have a few minutes left here, but to give us a little, you know, one of the big discussions these days is the minimum wage. And I know that's a federal issue, for the most part, a federal issue. But give us the NFIB's take on that.
Yeah, we're opposed to the proposal has been to raise it to about 10. There was a bill this year in the legislature, a couple bills actually in the state. One wanted to take it to $15 an hour. The other one was 10 and change. The president wants to raise it to, I think, 10. You know, my experience in dealing with the minimum wage is that, frankly, it's more of a political issue. It's more of an issue that unions can rally behind and try to perpetuate this, you know, whole workers versus management stereotype. But the reality is that in most small businesses, if they're even paying the minimum wage, it is for people who are in very much entry-level type jobs.
Absolutely.
They tend to not be in those jobs very long, because my experience is that if you start out making the minimum wage and you work hard and you learn whatever role it is you have in the business, that people want to try to get your pay up. Because business owners, you know, you ask any small employer and they'll tell you that if not their most valuable, the second most valuable part of their business is having good people.
Right.
And the way you keep and retain, the way you hire and keep good people is that you have to offer them a competitive wage. So paying somebody artificially depressed wages isn't a recipe for success for most businesses.
I don't know anyone that does that. That's always been kind of maddening to me to hear people make that argument about, I'm a fairly typical company here at EMA, and you know, we hire very skilled people. Well, those skilled people have marketplace values that if I don't pay that, or they have a value in the marketplace, if I don't pay it, my competitor will. I mean, there's no minimum wage business going on here. It's absurd.
Right.
The people I would pay minimum wage are somebody I might want to hire somebody to sweep out the warehouse or something.
Sure.
And if you push that to $15 an hour, I'm probably not going to do that. I mean, that's going to be the bottom line.
What we found is that when you artificially raise the minimum wage, it actually decreases the amount of opportunities for people who would be applying for minimum wage type jobs. And what it also does, and the reason I think that it's so problematic for a lot of small employers, is that the minimum wage, $7.50 today, if you raise it to $10 tomorrow, you've got people who are working for you who have been with you for a year, a couple of years, who are making, you know, $9, $10 an hour. All of a sudden, somebody new comes in, just because the government says now all of a sudden we have to pay them $10 an hour. The people who have been with you are like, well, wait a minute. You know, I'm here. I've got maybe not maybe I'm not in management, or I don't have a real skill, but, you know, I've done a good job. You're paying me more than the minimum wage. Now I want my income to be bumped up too. So sure. Now I want you to pay me $12 an hour. We call that wage creep. It's a real problem for small business. And again, I think it's sad and frankly telling that the president's signature economic policy here in his second term is to push for the minimum wage increase.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I mean, that's really kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel for ways to get our economy going.
Yep. Kyle, thank you so much for being a guest today. It's always fun to talk with you and always very informative, and I appreciate the job you do, and I hope that you keep doing it out there for us.
My pleasure, and if anybody wants more information, one thing we didn't talk about today was the Affordable Care Act. We've got lots of good information on it.
I had notes, we just never got to it.
It's just NFIB.com, and you can find whether you're an NFIB member or not. some great and helpful information on the website, and I would encourage everybody to check it out.
I would encourage everyone to go there and do that as well. The National Federation of Independent Business, a wonderful organization. If you own a business and you're not part of that, well, then you ought to be. Again, we're glad you're here today. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're here every week at this time on Driven to Business. We hope you've enjoyed today's program, and we'll see you again next week.
You've been listening to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Visit next Saturday at 11 a.m. on Biz 1190 for more Driven to Business. To learn more about Driven to Business, visit eddiemayfield.com or call 770-448-4644.